Big show on Thursday, January 30th. Adam Steinbaugh kicked it off from the group Fire. He talked about a controversial free speech case that's lingering at UConn. Ruth Canovi, director of advocacy for the American Lung Association in Connecticut, stopped by. She talked about a yearly report card regarding what Connecticut is doing and is not doing to try and help people quit smoking. UNH lecturer and former FBI agent Kenneth Gray gave us his outlook and predictions for the Fotis Doulos case. And Fairfield Trumbull, Republican State Rep. Laura Devlin capped off the show with what she knows so far about a controversial tolling bill. And we welcome Adam Steinbaugh to the show. Adam, Paul in Bridgeport, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
Good, Adam. Good. Well, you folks issued your 10 worst colleges for free speech in 2020. And I'm scrolling down the list the other day in my office, and I'm going, oh, look what school is on the list. The UConn Huskies. How, Adam? I think I know the answer to this, but we can set this up. How did UConn land on that list?
Well, it's a combination of what is probably the most offensive word in the English language and a heck of a overreaction to it. A couple months ago, a couple of students at the University of Connecticut were coming home from a local pizza place late in the evening. And as they were walking through a parking lot outside of a dormitory, they decided to play a very immature game where one student says an offensive word, somewhat quietly, and the other one says the same word a little bit louder, and they go back and forth to see who can say it the loudest. And they started off with the word penis, but they then switched to the N-word. And someone who was in the dormitory heard the students going back and forth, but didn't know what they were saying. And he recorded it on a cell phone. And when he played the video back later, he realized that they were saying the N-word, and he posted it online. And when the post went viral, the university dispatched their police department to look through surveillance cameras, to look through the Wi-Fi logs to see who had connected to the dormitory's internet at a particular time, and to look through the card access logs to see who had swiped their card to enter the dormitory so that they could try and figure out, who were the two students that were uttering this offensive word in a parking lot.
And so essentially they're reacting, and I don't mean to make light of this, Adam, because obviously it's an offensive word. You preface this by saying it might very well be the most offensive word in the English language. But again, we're talking about language here, something not really directed at anyone, a word that just about everyone has used in jest or whatever at one time. And UConn's police department and administration has essentially treated this like there was an armed shooter on campus.
Yeah, it's quite the overreaction. You know, as you point out, it wasn't directed at anyone. So, under the First Amendment, there are these well-known exceptions. One of those are fighting words. And in a different context, if they had been directing the same word, directed at someone's face, in a face-to-face encounter, that might amount to fighting words. But if you're not directing at anyone, as offensive as it might be, it's still protected speech.
Adam Steinbaugh is the guest. Adam, hang on. We'll do traffic and weather together, come back to you and get back into this. UConn makes a rather ignominious list from a group calling itself Fire. They've been around for several years. They watch whether or not your free speech rights, as egregious as they might be from time to time, are being violated on college campuses. And this arrest of these two guys, obviously dopes, perhaps alcohol involved. I'm shocked. Really? Booze on campus? Have their rights been violated? Traffic and weather together on the 6s here, 336 on WICC. As we continue at coming up on 338, how are you? Hope it's rolling well for you on a Thursday. Eric behind the board here. I'm Paul Pacelli. This is Connecticut Today, and our guest for a few more minutes here, representing the group. The group's acronym is FIRE, F-I-R-E. You can check them out online at TheFIRE, T-H-E-F-I-R-E.org, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. And FIRE spokesman Adam Steinbaugh is with us. So, Adam, this happened at UConn a few months ago. I remember when this broke, and it's a good thing I had a millennial producer or two to suddenly come whisper in my ear as I'm talking about this on the air, oh, that's the penis game. And I said, okay, this is what happens when you graduate from college in the early 80s. We never did that. But there's a bigger issue here, isn't there? Because, again, you know, Adam, you've got a kind of a controversial law here in Connecticut surrounding this whole case that I know a lot of civil libertarians in this state are a little bit up in arms about.
Yeah, it's you know, it kind of underscores why the university's response was so over the top. This statute under which they were arrested is a statute dating to the early 1900s, and it was about restricting commercial advertisements that were racially offensive. So the statute itself is about ads. These students weren't advertising anything, yet they were arrested for a statute dealing with advertising. And it turns out that Connecticut's police have been arresting people under this statute, basically using it as a tool to arrest people who use racially offensive language. And that often turns out to be racially offensive language directed at police officers, including white police officers. And that's, you know, whatever the legislature intended in the early 1900s, I don't think that's what they meant.
So you put UConn, unfortunately, on this list as a top 10 list, as you call it, the 10 worst colleges for free speech. And I guess before we talk about other schools and basic trends here on this list, I guess the case is still pending. Did they ever come to a resolution on this or not?
One of the students has accepted a plea agreement that allows this to be taken off of his criminal record. The other student is still being criminally charged. And on top of that, the university is also proceeding with student disciplinary charges. So not only have they been arrested, but they are also facing potential sanctions by the university itself. They have filed a lawsuit against the university, and that is still pending.
It'll be interesting to see. So we'll see what happens. You know, if there's a check written here, maybe, Adam, to make this go away. But talk a little bit more about, obviously, UConn's on this list, but some of the other schools here and the goal or what you intend you folks do at FIRE when you publish this annual Worst Colleges for Free Speech. And I know in the past you've been criticized, oh, you're just another right-wing group that wants to let people say anything they want. And I'm guessing that's not exactly what your motivation is here.
No, it is not. You know, this list is intended to give people kind of an overview of the different types of threats there are to free speech. It is not just conservatives who face restrictions on their speech on campus. It's people all over the political spectrum. So a good example of that, two instances took place at Portland State University, which wound up on our list this year. At the first one, a group of socialist students were holding a meeting, and a local conservative figure who is upset that this group has not sufficiently denounced Antifa decided that he was going to show up to their meeting and make them answer for Antifa. When the university police found out that this guy was going to show up, the police showed up to the socialist group meeting and made them cancel the meeting just because of the possibility that this conservative figure might show up and protest there. And then a couple weeks later, having learned absolutely no lessons whatsoever, the university police showed up to a college Republicans meeting, and there was a demonstrator from the left who used a cowbell to continuously ring throughout the meeting for about an hour so that they couldn't hold the meeting at all. And while this protester was doing this, the police stood by doing nothing. They didn't ask him to leave. They didn't make him leave. They did nothing.
What is, Adam, I know this is a, you know, rhetorical question, but I have to ask it, and you probably ponder it for hours and days. What the hell is everybody so afraid of? What were the cops afraid of by removing that protester that was disturbing the conservative gathering? And what would the cops or anybody else have been afraid of if that conservative protester was disturbing the liberal or the leftist gathering? What is everyone so afraid of? Is it Is it the administrations, Adam, on these schools' campuses who are like, please, please, we can't get involved in this? Is it a lack of a spine? What is it?
I don't know. If there were one Band-Aid or one silver bullet that we could come up with to end censorship for all, I think, you know, our jobs would be a lot easier and I could go home. But, you know, there doesn't seem to be one simple solution or one simple explanation. The general predisposition of people is to try and censor each other. And that's why we have the First Amendment. That's why we have this lawful protection for speech, because speech is threatened no matter what type of view you hold. And it's threatened by people from, you know, all over the political spectrum. So thankfully, we have this value-neutral system, you know, the First Amendment, that is supposed to protect that. But it requires people to stand up for their own rights, and it requires administrators and police officers to be able to defend those rights. But too often we see administrators or police officers either willing to do nothing or, worse, to take action which winds up censoring people.
And the thing that really distresses me, Adam, is you see this happening, this lack of guts to allow mainly conservatives, as you say, but it does go both ways. You see this happening at schools, ironically, like Berkeley, Cal Berkeley, which was the seat, the birthplace, largely, of the free speech movement of the 60s and 70s, where even far-left students and leftists and Democrats, they rallied, but they held speeches. They traded ideas, got rowdy at times, but nobody was really trying to be shut down. Or, for example, Brandeis in Massachusetts, famous now for shutting down people, named after a Supreme Court justice whose pet issue was, ironically, freedom of speech. It's really sad.
Sad. And, you know, one thing you do have to remember about Berkeley is Berkeley got that reputation because there were threats to free speech there, too. You know, that was about students from across the political spectrum standing up against an administration that was trying to shut down speech in an open area of the campus. So this is kind of a perennial sort of problem.
Adam Steinbaugh, thank you so much. The name of the group is FIRE. Check it out online, The Fire, THEFIRE.org, the 10 worst colleges for free speech, the 2020 list, and they have all different kinds of stories, ongoing updates on litigation that's going on against schools all over the country. If you are a parent or a grandparent who may be writing a check for your son, daughter, or grandson or granddaughter to go to school, you want to check out thefire.org. Adam Steinbaugh. Adam, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. American Lung Association's State of Tobacco Control Report has some pretty good things to say about the state of Connecticut. We're doing pretty well in some spots, but then again, there are areas that we could improve on. And joining us right now is the go-to person for us anytime there's news from the Lung Association. She's Director of Public Policy at the American Lung Association in Connecticut. Ruth Canovi is with us. Hi, Ruth. Paul again here in Bridgeport. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm all right. You know, keeping it together. Grades are out here for the state. I saw this release that you folks were so kind to send me the other day. And in a nutshell, how are we doing with prevention, smoking cessation, the things that the Lung Association is always concerned about? Before we get into the specifics, how are we doing overall?
You know, we have a real mixed grade here, but I do want to just kind of call out that it's better than I have been able to talk about in years, which is exciting. I've been doing this job for a while, and I feel like every year this report card has come out, it's been a lot of poor grades and frustration. And this year, at least, I feel like we've got some good news to talk about and hopefully some momentum to build off for improvement in the years to come.
Now, this is an annual report. I know you folks do. It's called the State of Tobacco Control. What is the purpose of this, Ruth? Why put this report together?
Yeah, and so this is the 18th annual report. And I think the Lung Association, you know, a number of years back, was just looking at the real need to implement best practices, kind of policies that we knew would make a difference in reducing tobacco use and the burden that tobacco has on kind of all of our lives and well-being, as well as kind of the financial health of many of our states. And so they identified at that point, I think there were four grades of kind of just best practices. And it's to kind of give people who make decisions in the state a roadmap of, like, we know that these things will be effective in reducing the burden of tobacco in our states. So let's do it and see how places are doing. So when they are doing well, we can recognize that. But when there's areas for improvement, we can also shine light on that and see what we can do to make improvements there.
The guest is Ruth Canovey. Ruth, hang on. We'll be right back to you. Traffic and weather together on the Sixes right here. We'll talk about the state of tobacco control here in the state of Connecticut, what we're doing well, what we're doing not so well in, and what we apparently aren't even trying to do. That's all straight ahead right here. 4:36, it's a Thursday here on WICC. To check that 4:37, 23 before 5, it's a Thursday here at WICC. We continue with Ruth Canovey. She's Director of Public Policy at the American Lung Association in Connecticut. And we're talking to Ruth here about the Engel Report, the state of tobacco control. Ruth, let's start. Why don't we just go for the jugular here? Because that's how I am. An area, Ruth, that the state constantly is criticized for, even though we got a lot of this tobacco settlement money years ago. Unfortunately, Connecticut gets an F, Ruth, for funding for state tobacco prevention programs. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, and so this is an area that's pretty troubling. And so every year the state receives money from that master settlement agreement you referenced number of years back. And so we also have one of the, I think the second highest cigarette tax rate in the country. And so the state received a decent amount of money every year coming in related to tobacco. And so starting fiscal year 2015, we haven't put any money into the Tobacco and Health Trust Fund. That was in the fund that was established right after that master settlement agreement to really put towards tobacco cessation and prevention funding and programs. And it really did some decent work here in the state of Connecticut. And they had, they planned on how we would spend some of those dollars. Mm-hmm. And we have not put any money. I mean, really, the CDC recommends that we put $32 million every year into tobacco prevention and cessation. And cumulatively, since we've been tracking this, we haven't met 1 year's amount. And so we clearly have a lot that we can improve on in this realm.
If that money were to be put in there, Ruth, what would the state do with it? Specific examples maybe of, all right, somebody may be saying, all right, Ruth, then how do we spend 32 or 30 million, however, a year to get people to stop smoking or never start? Ad campaigns, billboards, people doing outreach in schools? Is that what that would pay for?
Yeah. And so, I mean, historically, there was, a kind of a process where people would apply to participate in those funds from the Tobacco and Health Trust Fund. There'd be more money going to the quit line so that when people wanted to quit, they could call and get access right away to help. You know, there's so many people who use tobacco products actually want to quit. And so we want to ensure that services are available for them when they do that. But then also prevention. I think, this the outbreak, really the epidemic of youth tobacco use and vaping, using the electronic cigarettes, is kind of over the same time when we've really not been investing in lots of these programs. And so while we were seeing that all over the country, I think we could be doing a lot more to kind of counteract all of the money that the tobacco industry puts at getting young people hooked. We need some counter messaging there. So yes, some of that is in schools or after school programs, and some of it is with social marketing campaigns and just getting another voice out there to combat that targeting of young people.
Okay, so climbing the ladder now, we go from an F to a D, and I think this is hooked into what you just said. The state gets a D in the category of coverage and access to services to quit tobacco, so I'm guessing that's kind of what you were just paralleling for us.
Yeah, and so really that's an area where we kind of get mixed. We do okay in some areas within that category, but the place that really hits us the hardest is our lack of funding for the tobacco quit line that we have in the state of Connecticut. But we do actually, we do cover cessation for the Medicaid population. We're kind of one of the states that does not, or that does much better than some of the rest of the country. But because we just don't put any money into that quit line, it really hurts us in that grade. So it's a kind of a double hit there.
Yeah. We get a little bit better here. Now we go to a C for the strength in Connecticut, Ruth, of smoke-free workplace laws. C is better. It's better than a D or an F, but not as good as an A or a B. I would have thought that by now, and maybe you can correct me on this, that in the year 2020, we would have had kind of the workplace smoke thing figured out. But why only a C here?
Yeah, I mean, a number of our neighbors get A's in this regard. I mean, I think when Connecticut passed that original law, we were kind of one of the first, and so a number of compromises were made. Things like even like workplaces with fewer than 5 employees. There's also a little thing in our law that says that workplaces can actually have a smoking room. Hardly any of them do, but it's getting all of those exemptions off of the books that were made as compromises when we were kind of one of the first ones to get it. And closing those loopholes has proven more challenging than I anticipated. I mean, even last year, when we were looking at some of those laws with our Tobacco 21 law, we were able to address one that people were surprised at, that on school grounds, and people could actually smoke or use tobacco on school grounds and property when it wasn't in session or something going on. And so that was a loophole that was closed. But there's still other small things there that could certainly just bring us up on par with the rest of our neighbors. Because even when people are passing these laws in other states around the country that aren't typically as, public health forward as we can sometimes be, they pass better laws than we have here in Connecticut now.
Ruth Canovey is Director of Public Policy, the American Lung Association in Connecticut. We're looking at the State of Tobacco report for various states and tobacco control, rather, I'm sorry. Getting a little bit better, we climb the ladder here. Tobacco taxes, we are at a B here. So I guess we're high, Ruth, but maybe not high enough, people say.
Well, I think really where we hit here is that cigarettes are, I think Washington, D.C. is the only place that has a higher cigarette tax than we do. We're at $4.35 a pack, so that's significant. The issue where why we don't get an A is a number of other tobacco products aren't taxed at the same rate. And we know the reason why we kind of even look at tobacco taxes is it helps. So it helps as an incentive for people to quit. And so if you can go buy 2 little cigars for 89 cents, it's a very different thing than buying a pack for, $12. And so it's just kind of equalizing products and not necessarily picking winners or losers of kind of a type of tobacco product. And so that's why we get a B instead of an A in Connecticut.
And we do get an A, the best grade we have. And I know this was a pretty big deal when it was accomplished. The age for the sale of tobacco and vaping products now in Connecticut is, in fact, a 21.
Yeah, that was a big win. And I think when I talked to you last year, there were 6 states in the country that had passed that law. And this year we were one of 13. And in fact, in December, the federal government passed it. And so, in fact, this is kind of the law of the land everywhere now. And I think it's because of the fact that so many places kind of moved the bar and pushed, and there was so much momentum that not only now are we kind of in a good place for Connecticut, but all over the country. This was a big year for this issue.
Final issue. So I'm a little pressed for time here, but I did want to bring this up to you. Finally, in the report here, it says the Connecticut high school tobacco use rate is still at 17.9%, or roughly 18% of all high schoolers are using tobacco. Doesn't count, of course, vaping and everything, but the tobacco thing, that's a little surprising to me. Did that surprise you or not?
No. I think when you look at the cigarette rates, you know, those are low, 3.5%. But people who are using tobacco, and I think that's rising. I wouldn't be surprised if that was a higher number next year. And so it's disappointing, but products are becoming more and more, they're easier to hide. They're really interesting with all of the different flavors that are available. Mm-hmm. And so it's clear that we need to do a lot more.
Ruth Canovi, Director of Public Policy, American Lung Association in Connecticut. Ruth, as always, thank you for taking the time. We appreciate it, and keep us updated on this, okay?
Thank you so much for covering this. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Ruth. No problem. The current lecturer at the University of New Haven, he's a former FBI special agent who has experience in cases like this, can give us a law enforcement point of view, another point of view on this. We welcome Kenneth Gray to the show. Ken, Paul on WICC, how are you?
Hi, Paul. Thank you. I'm good. How are you?
Good. Thanks for stopping by. We appreciate it. Well, Ken, you know, everybody's talking about this case. It's obviously looks to be a tragic case. We all think we know what happened to the mother here, but still innocent until proven guilty, and there is no body found yet. But at this point in the case, Ken, what's your overall view of what has happened here, how the investigation has been run, and where we really stand here with a suspect who is clinging to life?
You know, this is a very interesting case in that this is one of those murder cases where they are going to trial without a body. It's very hard to do. New Canaan Police Department has done a great job in getting to that point where they can go forward with this case, despite the fact that they do not have Jennifer Dulos's body. And so, this should be a pretty remarkable case. Hopefully we will see it go to prosecution.
And, yeah, that's the big question now, obviously, Ken, is what condition will Fotis Doulos be in? You know, he was at first, you know, yesterday reported dead. Then he had a faint pulse, and he's going to have to spend several days in this hyperbaric oxygen chamber. And then the question is, from a prosecutorial point of view, Ken, for the state and for the prosecutor here, obviously, I would think maybe, you never know, his counsel, if he does survive, Norm Pattison, his lawyers, they may try and maybe get him out of a trial because of his physical, whatever the lingering results are of this poisoning.
Well, I think that at this point, we'll have to see how this plays out as far as his health goes before we can make any speculation about how this trial will turn out. At this point, it's on hold for him. However, he has two co-conspirators that are also being charged with this conspiracy to commit murder. And so their cases will probably be on hold too, but I don't know that for a fact. But he is one of three possible defendants in this case.
And Ken, obviously, you know from your career and other law enforcement officials I've spoken with, the key here, I would think, Ken, is do the either one of the other two defendants here, Mr. Marwini or his now former girlfriend, Michelle Traconis, do they know where the body is, right, or what may have been done with the body if it has not been buried in whole?
Well, with a case like this here, you're hoping that one of them would flip and provide information for lesser charges. So far, it has not happened. This may throw a monkey wrench into that attempt to get one of them to flip.
You mentioned earlier, Ken, regarding the police work here. I find it fascinating, and I've talked to law enforcement people who have been in the business a long time, way before everybody having a cell phone camera, way before these doorbell cameras, way before major highways had some sort of video, before the advent of DNA. Really, the technological advancements here, Ken, probably if they weren't around, I don't know how a case is made here. As you say, all the police departments here piecing this all together has just been fascinating.
They've done a remarkable job at building this case with the lack of a body. It's just absolutely remarkable. But the thing that I really find most remarkable is the use of the surveillance cameras, is that the use of the surveillance cameras really show that we've moved into a surveillance society. The fact that people are on cameras all the time.
You may have heard that when the arrest warrant was issued, the reaction from Norm Pattis and his defense team, which is to be expected, when he was asked about all the DNA evidence, and you and I probably read the same part of the warrant where they listed all the evidence there, all the DNA. You know, Norm Pattis, and I understand he's the attorney, he's paid to say this, he essentially said, well, big deal, transactional DNA. There's no body yet. The DNA really, Ken, do you think with the video, is that the... And the fact that they tracked down these garbage bags in Hartford, are those maybe the three pillars of a prosecution here?
Well, that's part of it. You have the blood in the house with both DNA. You have the blood in the vehicle. You have the blood on the clothing. So, you know, by convincing the medical examiner's office that this was enough to show that something violent had happened to Jennifer, that was enough to say that they could move forward with a murder case without a body. And so, of course, the defense is going to try to make the argument otherwise. So then that's why it has to play out in court, is whether or not the state has enough to convince a jury, or whether the defense can convince a jury that that this is not murder. But I think the state has done a remarkable job of building a case despite they don't have a body.
And we saw Ken about 20-something years ago in this state. In fact, he's up for parole pretty soon. We saw in the Richard Crafts case, another high-profile case, right, without a body. But that was one of the first high-profile cases, Ken, that the DNA and bone fragments and blood were really used to, you know, put Richard Crafts behind bars.
So in that particular case, they found some toenails, I believe,
yep.
Some fingernails. They found a small amount of tissue, and they had the report of the snowplow driver that saw the wood chipper being used on this bridge during the time. That was a remarkable case in itself. They built a good case. Our own Dr. Lee was part of that investigation. So that was really a remarkable case. So that is the case that I thought of immediately when I heard about this case, is that this is very similar playing out to that of the Crafts case. And I think that that the state spent a sufficient amount of time to show that they were exhausting all possible avenues, and then they moved forward with the case despite the fact that they lacked a body to be able to move into the prosecution phase. So I think they've done a wonderful job getting to that point.
And Ken, finally, there all the forensics and everything that can be laid out as far as times and blood evidence and surveillance and all this. But you probably know through your long career in law enforcement that the case also will probably have, Ken, and correct me if I'm wrong, a component here for a murder. And the prosecution, beyond the forensics here, they have to show that, you know, there was, you know, an emotional crash here. There was rage. There was anger. Something went wrong here. It's not only about forensics, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, they have to be able to build that case, and they have to convince the jury. They have to show a state of mind. They have to fill out the whole picture. But I think that they were getting there, that I think they are there, and that that hopefully this case is just temporarily on hold so that the state gets a chance to take their shot at it. It would be a shame that he manages to deny justice being done by opting out this way.
He's a former FBI special agent, currently a lecturer at the University of New Haven, Kenneth Gray. Ken, thank you, and hopefully we can speak down the road. We appreciate it. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Okay, Bob. Republican State Rep serving Fairfield and Trumbull, Laura Devlin, joins us on the show. Hi, Laura. It's Paul at WICC. How are you?
Hey, I'm great, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
Well, have you seen an actual bill, or are we still in the are we in the draft stage? Has anything changed?
So we are still in the draft stage, as far as I'm aware, and that is the LCO 373 that's been, you know, floating around and being talked about. Yeah,
you know. The fact that you have said, that you use the phrase, Laura, that I'm aware of or something like that, that a lot of people have called me in the show saying, well, come on, what's going on? I said, well, when half of the General Assembly doesn't know and they're locked out of the room, there's not a whole lot to know until they come out with a finished product, right?
Right, right. And the fact that this is Thursday night. We have a public hearing tomorrow. I've never heard of a public hearing on a working draft. Just shows that they are still trying to wrangle votes in the House and the Senate.
It's got to, as a legislator, Laura, it's got to drive you guys crazy. And to me, and I said this yesterday, this to me is beyond party. Yes, partisan politics is the root of everything in politics, but just common sense. You would think in this compressed time frame that this wouldn't be the way to go, but maybe I'm the crazy one.
You know what? It is incredibly frustrating, but it's frustrating because it is disingenuous and dishonest to the taxpayers in the state of Connecticut. This is not the way that business should be done in the state capitol at all.
Laura, hang on. I want to be right back with you. I did read a couple of bullet points of the draft, a couple of which have got me a little uneasy. Be right back with Laura Devlin, Republican state rep serving residents of Fairfield and Trumbull, as we continue to figure out what's going on with this toll bill. Back with Laura and more. Traffic and weather together on the sixes here as we continue on a Thursday on WICC. 5:36, almost 5:37, less than 24 hours away from a public hearing on another toll bill of the Capitol, and nobody has seen a finished version of the bill yet, believe it or not. State Rep. Laura Devlin, Republican, Fairfield and Trumbull, joining us for a few more minutes. Laura, I read some of the bullet points that were posted after the draft by the folks at the Yankee Institute and other spots. And listen, I want to preface this, Laura, because I always do. I have the highest respect for organized labor, for union labor. I think unions play a vital role in our society, in our democracy, in our economy. However, when I see that one of the seats on this proposed board that would regulate tolls has been reserved, I guess what I'm reading here, Laura, to a union member, and then you scroll down and you find that, oh, by the way, the contract labor agreements are going to be enforced here. I sit back and I think, okay, is this, do they not even hide it anymore? Is this thank you for the votes? I'm sorry, Laura, but, you know, if you want to do that, then you better explain why.
This isn't the only example, Paul, that I have seen where there's actually been legislation submitted, not under a legislator's name, but actually under a union, which is amazing. But, you know, all along with this whole toll discussion, the only people who were in favor of tolls largely were those who would benefit from it. And as you point out, there are project labor agreements in this bill, which means the state is dictating that any construction work goes only to union shops. Now, I agree with you. I'm all, you know, organized labor, great. Quite frankly, I don't care who gets the work. But it should be based on fair competitive bidding. And that's knocked out with the way that this bill is written.
And it's sad because 85%, Laura, you've probably seen this figure. I've talked to union officials. 85% of construction workers, men and women in the state, for whatever reason, do not work for union shops. So this knocks 85% of those people, unless they go and work for one of these companies and join, it knocks them right out of an opportunity to work on these projects.
Absolutely. And these are individuals, you know, companies that they pay their employees well. They have great benefits. They are highly skilled. They are dedicated professionals. But because of the influence of labor in our state government, these are the kinds of things we see where they're knocked out.
Do you have the same concerns, Laura, that Senator Frisano and some other legislators on the Republican side do, that there are holes in this thing, and no matter what assurances are given about not having any intention to blah, 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 or we would never try blah, 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 are you concerned that there are holes in this bill, or maybe that will be in the final version of the bill, that will eventually lead to the tolling of passenger vehicles?
Oh, there are holes, no doubt about it. You know, it's sort of like the Special Transportation Fund, right? So that was created as a lockbox, but because it really wasn't locked, it became a constitutional amendment. The reality is that language did not change at all. It's sort of the spin that's given to give comfort to taxpayers while they're getting the wool pulled over their eyes. In this case, absolutely, they try to offer a guarantee that, you know, tolls will not expand beyond trucks, yet there are multiple ways around it. And the Speaker of the House even admitted it in a recent Chamber of Commerce meeting, where he said, well, any legislature can do anything. So, you know, after the next election, sure, they could change it. Absolutely.
Yeah, and I mean any legislative body which locks out a future edition of that body from making changes, I think they would be shirking their duties. You cannot let people who will follow your footsteps, do something like that. It just makes no sense. Laura, finally, do you get the sense that no matter how many of these sweeteners are put in and no matter how this thing is tweaked, do you get the sense that there will eventually be enough votes on the Democratic side to do this? Or is this still going to be a tough slog, especially in an election year for the Democratic leadership?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because there's sort of some late breaking news coming across the Twitter feeds from Ken Dixon and from Mark Davis, that there will not be a special session next week now.
Oh.
Now, I don't know how that transpired. I would say hooray to everybody who's voicing their opinions. I would still say come to the Capitol tomorrow and really make clear to the Transportation Committee chairs and Democrat members and everybody else that, you've had enough. Enough of this.
Okay, so as you have heard, there is no special session coming up, but the full session will still happen then, the short session, right?
Absolutely, and we have opening day on Wednesday. So whether this will become a part of the legislative debate during the regular session, which quite frankly is the right way to do it, as opposed to trying to cram things through 2 days before session, we'll see.
All right. And Laura, finally, to me, and I know you've heard this from people, to me, it's not a matter of party, Democrat, Republican, Congress, communist, socialist, I don't care. But the fact of the matter is, we're having such trouble on these things here in a great state occupied by great people, because we've lost, or the General Assembly, the body as a whole, Laura, because of all the promises that were kept and that were made and not kept. It really is a matter of trust now. People, and it's sad to say, Laura, in such a great state, a lot of people simply don't trust anything that comes out of the Capitol, and it's sad. It really is.
It is sad. And, I can say, Democrat, Republican, we agree we need to invest in our infrastructure. That should be a top priority. Where we disagree is implementing a new revenue stream, to your point of trust in government, that we know will be abused just like every other. And we've got to stop reaching into the pockets of the taxpayers in the state of Connecticut. We can create more efficiencies in our government. We need to slow spending. There are other alternatives than continuing to reach for more money.
Laura, thank you. We appreciate it. And keep us up to date. We'll check in maybe next week with you. We appreciate it. Thanks.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks. State Rep. Laura Devlin there.